All those I know, hello. All those I don't know, welcome. Welcome back. The Dharma, incomparably profound and minutely subtle. There are so many, there are infinite ways to present the Dharma. Actually, the Dharma is infinite in that the details of all of the world and life are infinite. There are the traditional teachings, and very often Dharma talks open up traditional teachings, kind of focus on traditional teachings. But then part of the job that I have as a senior practitioner is to open up the Dharma, the classical teachings in current terms, because this is the way we are experiencing our lives. So I wanted to really focus in that way tonight on what I'm talking about. And I wanted to talk about not knowing. So all Dharma is marked by certain characteristics. One is impermanence. Everything is impermanent. Any form, any thought, anything, any state of mind or energetic body or continent, impermanent. Everything is interdependent, interdependently arising. Everything arises simultaneously all together. And everything is empty of independent, fixed self-nature because of that, because it's interdependent and it's continually changing. We call this emptiness, or we call it openness, or we call it uncertainty, or we call it don't know. The Korean Zen master Son Sennin he's not alive anymore, but always talked about don't know mind. That one of the things that we really come to see as we engage over time in a meditation practice is that everything changes. And we don't know. We may think we know. We may know certain things. Right now, we in this world that's in an incredibly difficult moment, there are certain things we know. But what the outcome of these things are, how they will play out, none of us know. What we should do about the situations that we're facing, we don't know. We don't know what to do, because what has been done before has deepened the issues that we're all suffering with. Taking sides, not helpful, deepening the problems. But what do we do? What do we do? So really, getting comfortable with uncertainty is one of the gifts of this practice, because it's just the way it actually is. Think of today. Did it go exactly as you planned? My day was totally different, and actually most days are. I think I know what I'm going to do. That's not the way it goes. Or it pretty much sticks to it, but what I was anticipating is kind of a cartoon version of the details of how it is, the moment-by-moment experience. So really, the truth is, everything is quite uncertain. And we can have more of a sense of patience, goodwill, and readiness to respond when we really are open to the uncertainty of things. So I wanted to read a quote from actually a wise person who's from Nigeria, Bayo. Is anybody familiar with Bayo here? Okay, so this is the language of this quote is just so startling. I couldn't resist. I'm quite confident. He titled it Something to Ponder on the First Day of This New Year of This New Decade. And this is, by the way, 2020. 2020 vision is unimpeded vision, accurate vision. Well, may this be so, but I don't know. Anyway, I'm quite confident, he says, that even as the oceans boil and the hurricanes beat violently against our once safe shores, and the air sweats with the heat of impending doom, and our fists protest the denial of climate justice, that there is a path to take that has nothing to do with victory or defeat. A place we do not yet know the coordinates to. A question we do not yet know how to ask. The point of the departed arrow is not merely to pierce the bullseye and carry the trophy. The point of the arrow is to sing the wind and remake the world in the brevity of flight. There are things we must do, sayings we must say, thoughts we must think, that look nothing like the images of success that have so thoroughly possessed our visions of justice. May this new decade be remembered as the decade of the strange path, of the third way, of the broken binary, of the traversal disruption, the kairotic moment. Do you know what kairos is, anybody? Kairos means a propitious moment for decision or action. This must be a propitious moment because this is the moment we've got. The post-human movement for emancipation, the gift of disorientation, and this practice certainly gives us the gift of disorientation, that opened up new places of power. Where do we get our power from now? And of slow limbs. May this decade bring more than just solutions, more than just a future. May it bring words we don't know yet and temporalities we have not yet inhabited. May we be slower than speed could calculate, and swifter than the pull of gravity of words can incarcerate. And may we be visited so thoroughly and met in wild places so overwhelmingly that we are left undone, ready for the impossible. And then he finishes with, "Welcome to the decade of the fugitive." He's quite an articulate person. Really striking language. If I were not about what I'm going to be talking about, I would stop and just delve into this particular quote. It's just amazing. And also, you can find him on YouTube. He has a lot of talks that he's given. He's really quite something. So he says, "Welcome to the decade of the fugitive." A fugitive. There are many fugitives, depending on who defines the person. There are many governments that define people who are standing up for just causes as fugitives, right? There certainly are many, many immigrants. There are many refugees that do not know what comes next. 70 million refugees, 70.4 million refugees this last year in the world. Something like 37,000 every day are fleeing. And these are many difficult conditions that are, we cannot separate climate change from the ignorance and hatred and greed that has kind of taken over the resources of the world. It's all arising together, intimately interconnected. Which makes it even harder to know what to do, because we are all aware. You want to choose your, you know, years ago when I was part of a movement to stop the Trident sub, that was a big campaign. We could choose one thing, and what we were always told is choose one issue and work on it for your whole life. Learn all about it, and follow it, and advocate for wisdom paths in relation to it. But now, you know, where do you start? How do you separate? So we have reached. We have to have 20/20 vision. And it's impossible. We cannot know what will emerge from these current circumstances. And this throws us back entirely on our practice. What can you contribute to the outcomes? What can I contribute to the emergent world? What do I do when I sit on the cushion? What do I do every day with my life energy? This always is pointing us back to our practice, and thank God we have practice. Because without it, looking out and around, it's very hard to see anything to be done. With practice, we know the next moment is the moment to really engage fully. This is a practice of radical not knowing. Radical. Radical is affecting the fundamental nature of something. To be able to deeply not know, to not take a position, stand firmly, and then disconnect, disengage, that's the problem. Not that we don't take stands, but that the way we've been taking stands has been in a way that disconnects and provokes more disconnection. So we begin with our meditation. And to this end, I want to introduce it tonight. To this end, we're going to begin on the first day of our upcoming sesshin, which is going to be the Climate of Mind sesshin. And we have a sign-up sheet out there. Anybody who wants to participate in 90 hours in 90 days. So it's a commit to sit period of time. That would mean that you can parse out that 90 hours over 90 days any way you want, any way that works for you. You could sit 1 hour, a solid hour, or you could sit 2 half hours, or you could sit 6-10 minutes. However you do it, do it. And watch how it affects. How it affects how you operate, how you function, what you see, what you notice. We're doing this as a sangha because we wouldn't do it on our own. I mean, occasionally somebody really has this fortitude and this iron determination to do it on their own, but mostly it's part of the jewel that the sangha is that we're all doing this together. And we'll be checking in, so we can check in sanzen. And we can check in on Tuesday nights during our Dharma discussion, and we can just keep checking in about how it's going. Now, some people already meditate an hour a day, so increase it if you can, or appreciate it. Definitely appreciate it. Don't take it for granted. And then at the end of that time, we're going to have a ceremony where we'll take personal vows. And we'll do that as a sangha together. So you can be thinking about, how does this kind of practice, how do you want to take it forward? What kind of commitment do you want to run through your long life? So there may be some discoveries there. You certainly can discover more about your awake states and your forgetful states. Which brings me to my next topic, improv. Because we had an improv workshop yesterday, which was extremely good Dharma practice. And I think it's going to be something that we will do periodically together. One of our members is studying improv and led us in this. Improv really makes our inner and outer functioning so transparent. So it's very important to meditate. Now, one of the things that the person who taught this commented on, he's studied with a group in New York, and most of the people in the group that he's studying with are actors, and they're filled with their own knowing, and they had much more trouble than we had. He said, "You guys, you just go right for it," and it's because we really, whether we have noticed it or not, have developed a habit of remaining more open, which you have to do if you're improvising. So there are 14 of us. And so I was noticing a number of things. First of all, we all had to get up in front of each other and not know what was going to come at us and what we were going to do about it and how foolish we were going to look and how stumped we could be. Uh-oh, what do I do with this? You know. You all were facing the unknown in public. And we had to put it all on the line. It was this is all comedy improv, but the thing that was emphasized was, don't worry about being funny. You just have to respond. And what came out? What came out was amazing.
It was hysterical.
Because it was fresh, and it was so human. And actually, some of the most wonderful comedians are those who are absolutely bare about the human condition. And we certainly were. We had to observe. We had to observe our own, and the first few exercises were observing our own internal body states and each other's body states. And then words came later. You have to, in improvisation, you have to let go of your agendas. It's a moment-by-moment thing. And coming into opposition to whatever you're given. So somebody says something, the mantra is yes and. Somebody says something and you need to build on it and take it and bring it even more alive and add more to it, right? Which is what we do anyway, sometimes. A lot of the time we come into opposition. And then we produce a world out of thin air. There we are on a bare floor, and suddenly we're in the middle of Victoria's Secret, measuring a guy for a bra. Where'd that come from? We have to coordinate with another person and be open to whatever they give us and relate to it intimately. It can't be my fantasy versus your fantasy. But when that happened, all we could do was laugh, because one person, it happened to me a lot, I didn't know what the other person was talking about, which happens to be my life. I mean, it was not a new experience. So, you know, this term that Bayo says, the gift of disorientation, is really what came out of this improv workshop. It was very disorienting continually. We had to turn on a dime, as we say in Zen. It's really, really something. So it really pointed to our mind, how it operates, showed us the emptiness of our thoughts. You know, they're from nowhere, and they just completely dominate how we experience. And then we could see how language would narrow us into a set. If we spoke the same language, but we didn't always speak the same language. Like I one of the improvs that I was part of, I realized we were given the word fence. And so fence, in the world that I grew up in New York, a fence was somebody who you'd bring stolen goods to and they would give you money for it, right? Or they'd pass it along. But the person I was doing this with was thinking, what are you talking about? She was only picturing a fence, you know, the kind of built. It was very funny and very much what happens all the time. And it's actually one of the things that comes up in Zen practice, because there's so much language in Zen practice that if you're in it any length of time, you get used to it. But somebody walking in fresh doesn't know what it means and what you're referring to. And I think it's something that we all need to keep in mind as we get used to the practice, because we want to welcome anybody in and say it's okay not to know. And I use a language, and I'm constantly realizing I don't really fully know the implications of some of these things. They just keep unfolding. These teachings are ancient. They've come through so many thousands of people. They're layered in significance. And then come into our culture where they're fresh again and differently seen. Does that make sense? So, so when we meditate, we're doing a form of practice. Meditation is a skillful means, and it's also a kind of a natural mind. It's everything. But we do it still. We're still when we do it physically. We're relatively still. We're silent. And we're solo, even when we're in a group. It's always our own self experience. But improv is definitely a Zen practice that breaks out of all of that. We do it together, and it's loud. And it's completely unpredictable, whereas in Zen, everything is predictable. It's choreographed. Zen is a choreography. You come in here, you bow in certain ways, and that is a skillful means. The reason for that is, in order to become very concentrated and still and present, our minds can't be trying to figure out what to do next, right? So when you come into a Zendo, you don't have to think about anything. You just do the dance. You just sit down, and the only thing that needs to be tracked is the breath, and then finally not even that. So this is a different kind of practice. So Wei Neng, who is the sixth Zen ancestor, was giving us improv instruction when he said, "The Dharma is not dual, neither is the mind. The Tao is pure and has no form at all. Take care not to contemplate purity or to make the mind empty." Now that's important. Hear that. This is not about making the mind empty. The mind is from the outset pure. You don't have to make it pure. The mind from the outset is complete. There's nothing you must grasp or throw away. Nothing in excess, nothing too little. Just right. Each one of you must exert herself, himself, themselves. Leave now and go to wherever circumstances lead you. And that's really what we do as we improvise our life. we may lose track of the improvisational nature of our life because we all get into ruts. The alarm goes off in the morning and you just begin, you do the same thing over and over again. Maybe. One of the challenges in retirement is like, well, I could do anything. And I lose the rhythm, you know. So usually we have a certain rhythm in our life. We certainly have rhythms in the seasons, although those are changing also. But we use the same patterns over and over and forget that actually every single moment is completely open. It's not predetermined, not necessarily. It's open to new information, new responses, new many possibilities. There's that phrase, I don't know who said this, but the mind that knows, for the mind that knows, there is only one possibility. For the mind that does not know, there are many possibilities.
Suzuki Roshi.
Who's that?
Suzuki Roshi.
Suzuki Roshi, yeah. Thank you. So we can practice a radical flexibility that our lives demand. And we begin by noticing when we think we know. When we think we know. And becoming aware of how narrowed we can become in our attitudes, in our responses, in our physical movements, how we spend money, how we love, how we're friends or not friends, who we hate, how we drive. Interesting to ride with somebody else. I mean, when you're usually the driver, it's interesting to drive with somebody who you've never driven with. That too. You know, everybody has their own ways of doing things. But we want to really, really see into our own so that we can contribute everything we have to benefit the world. This is the Bodhisattva vow. Not holding back because of not understanding ourselves, not knowing ourselves, because we're fearful, because we're self-conscious, or we've lost heart, but steadily engaging with spirit and with heart. Steadily engaging everything. And knowing truthfully when we are not, and wondering, what, why, what's going on for me now, with a very warm and compassionate attitude toward what we notice our limitations are. We can, in spiritual practice, and especially in Zen, we can become our own worst slave driver, because it has that look. But this is not about deepening our slavery, but it's about really finding the liberation that is always available. So I just want to finish with a dedication of merit. I think this comes from another Sangha. We recited it at this Mahasangha Sit. Our prayer that any goodness generated here be extended out into the world. May all places be held sacred. May all beings be cherished. May all injustices of oppression and devaluation be fully righted, remedied, and healed. May all wounds to forests, rivers, deserts, oceans, all wounds to Mother Earth be lovingly restored to bountiful health. May all beings everywhere delight in whale song, bird song, and blue sky. May all beings abide in peace and well-being, awaken and be free. So may we all really appreciate our possibilities what to do with our consciousness, our heart energy, with our muscle energy, with our time on this planet, and use it fully and well and with joy and great determination to be of benefit.